Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everywhere we go, people want to know who we are and where we come from. So who are you and where did you come from?
I am Jennifer Carroll and I'm from Tala, Dublin.
And are you're Jen or are you Jennifer?
Jen.
Jen, yeah. Okay, Jen.
I'm Jennifer when someone's annoyed at me.
Okay. So Jen, you are one of the biggest stars, the Irish stars on Instagram. You're like, oh, but you are. You have a massive following on Instagram. And what is the Instagram about? Tell me about that first.
So the Instagram is, it kind of started out as a weight loss journey page. So I was starting at the beginning of a weight loss journey and I would share my weight losses every week and then share my meals, started to introduce a little bit of fitness into it. It just kind of grew from there. Now it's just more recipe based, not so much on the weight loss. I kind of got to a comfortable place, I suppose, with my weight and I wasn't so focused on the losses. So it's just recipes that have, you know, the breakdown of calories, step-by-step recipe ingredients. And I think the reason that I even have a big following, I always say, and I'm terrible for saying, I'm like, my page is quite boring. I think it's just, it's convenient, it's helpful, and I'm quite consistent with it. So like, I'll always be posting recipes. I feel like people are always going to be tracking calories and food. Mm-hmm. So it's always helpful for people. But it's definitely not the most exciting page.
But I think it's also the fact that you're very genuine on it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, people say that a lot, which I think is nice. You know, you're very similar in person than you are online. And I shared a lot as well about post-weight loss. I had surgery, so I had all skin removal surgery. I still have a couple to go. They were kind of postponed due to COVID. But that kind of got me a new big audience, I suppose, because it's something that's very different in Ireland. There was a lot of those pages out there in the UK, America, Australia. But even before I went for my surgery, I found it really hard to research the kind of surgery that I wanted. So I was kind of in two minds if I would share it, because like it is quite personal and I felt very vulnerable putting certain pictures out there. But I just kind of thought, you know, majority of the people that are following me are on weight loss journeys themselves. And so many people had reached out to say that they'd also be looking to get that kind of surgery. So I just decided to be open with it. And that actually got me quite a big following. I think I got, that was one of my biggest jumps, like 10,000 followers in like 5 days or something after my very first surgery. It was massive. Like I went up huge in my followers. And that was a little bit scary because I was like, oh God. But the, like, amount of people I had reach out to me afterwards about the surgery, and even the surgeon at the time that was like, I went through the Avoca, and the surgeon that did my first one was like, the surgery I performed on you, he said, I never perform a fleur-de-lis, like it's quite rare because it's usually massive weight loss. And he was,
what,
like,
is it?
So the fleur-de-lis is so a standard tummy tuck would be, you know, kind of gone from your hip to your hip, like a long C-section scar, basically, and they pulled the skin down. But because I had lost 12 stone, I obviously had a lot of excess skin, and I unfortunately was just someone that had a massive amount of skin. So it's basically like an upside down capital T. So they go from hip to hip and then they go up the center of your stomach right between your breasts. So the scar is quite big, but it's just a line. And that's so that they can pull the skin down and also in. And like, I had that done and they were like, there's still a lot of skin. Like, we're going to have to redo that in a year or two because you just have so much excess skin. So I remember the surgeon saying that to me. He's like, I never perform these. And then he was like booked out for 6 months or something after that. Because loads of people reached out and they were like, I didn't even know that this was a thing. Like, I didn't know it was possible in Ireland. I think a lot of people as well go abroad and they would hear of that. But they were like, I didn't even know that you could get these kind of surgeries. Like in the Avoca, I think when people thought the Avoca, they think of like breast implants.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that kind of stuff, a nose job. Or those kind of surgeries, they were like, I didn't realize you could get, and then I had the skin removed from my arms, which I shared, and then I'll be getting my legs done at the end of the year on my back. So
what does it feel like with 12 stone loss? Like, what does that do for you?
It's great. Like, I remember when I first lost, when I got to the 12 stone, I think it was actually when I lost my 10 stone award. My mom is tiny, like she's 4 foot 10 or 4 foot 11. I remember she was like, you've lost me. Yeah. She's like, imagine like you carrying me around constantly on your shoulders. Obviously it doesn't feel like that, but I think it's the difference of like the quality of life. Do you know, the kind of the way like I do try, and like I've been really consistent and dedicated with the gym, and I go 5 days a week. And I remember when I first started back to basics, I started a PT, and on my very first day, Sean was like, you know, we're just going to see what you can do. Like, you don't have to do the program that we're doing. I just want to see what you're capable of. And I think it was a lunge he got me to do, and I tried to go down the lunge, and like I just fell to the side. I couldn't even do it. I just had never exercised at all. And I remember months and months down the line, when I was getting stronger, he was like, but you have to like look at the positives. He's like, you were carrying all that extra weight around. He's like, you are so strong now. Like, your muscle that you would have built up from carrying, you know, the last 20 years, that extra like 12 stone on you. So it's just little things. Like, I feel like people that have lost a lot of weight would say, do you know, just walk, going out walking, and like not feeling kind of breathless, and being able to get up in the morning and start my day with like intense exercise. Like, I never imagined that I'd be someone that would be like that, or that would enjoy doing that kind of stuff. But I just love that. And I remember the first time I went down to like the park beside my house, like with Carter, my little boy, on a bike. And I was like, you know, just cycling or just running down the field with a football, like so many little things that you'd never think of. That obviously I could have done when I was bigger, but I was a very, very self-conscious big person. Like, I was far too self-conscious. I had no self-esteem. So I wouldn't have done those things. And I think that was one of the big pushes, was having Carter, because I was like, this is going to affect his life. Do you know, like, I'm going to hold him back because I hold myself back. So that was kind of the big push, I suppose.
It's mad. And I wonder if that's where other people in other situations and that are going to Turkey to get this weight loss surgery done. And I wonder, that is that why? And I know a friend of mine has done it, and she has a son as well, and she's done it for her son. But I do, like, do you have an opinion on what's happening with so many people going to Turkey? Because I do. And like, I just think people are, I don't think people are crazy, because I think it's very dangerous. And I know that people say it's the easy way out. I know it's absolutely not the easy way out, because when they can't eat when they come back, or, and it's crazy. So that's my opinion. I feel it's very dangerous.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's a hard one. I wouldn't say I have an opinion on it in such, like, it's not so black and white. Like, you're like, it's hard to say. I did inquire about weight loss surgery when I lived in London for 9 years, and before I had my little boy, I was in a place where I was desperate. I felt like I had tried everything. I felt like I had no option. And I just was like, I'm putting myself into an early grave. And, you know, it's either do that or risk the weight loss surgery. Now, I was in London, so it was covered by the NHS, I think, when you fall into a certain BMI category. But there was a waiting list. So I think maybe I felt a little bit safer because I was technically having it done at home in London. But with the going abroad, it's, for me personally, it was just my non-negotiable. I just wanted it done in Ireland. It's twice the price in Ireland. Like, the money is crazy, but I was just absolutely terrified of traveling. And even after having the surgeries, like, I don't know how people travel after those surgeries, like, fair play to them. And then I had discussed it a lot with surgeons over here, and the surgeons here would have quite a strong opinion on how safe it is getting it done abroad. And I know my surgeon Cormac, he has seen and worked on so many people that he's had to do, you know, corrective surgery on, and they've always had it done abroad. So now that would be kind of skin removal and stuff like that. The weight loss surgery, I know a lot of people do go abroad for that. I have a few friends that have done it. I think when I went to the doctor in England and he told me my options, now I knew there was a waiting list, I was like, I'm going to take some time and think about it. And the more I thought about it, for me, I was like, my issue is emotional eating, and my issue is binge eating. I comfort binge and I secret eat. I said I can go and get a surgery where I physically can't do it, but I'm not working on my head, you know, mm-hmm. what I need yeah. to be working on. I said, I need to look at me and what I'm doing and fix, like get my head sorted rather than physically stopping myself. Because I know people, friends that have had it done mm. and then gained the weight back over the years. And obviously that's not to say everyone does. I've seen so many people, I follow people that have had like incredible results, and there's a lot of hard work. Like you said, it's not an easy way out. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. But I think I was just so worried that I would do it, but I wouldn't change or yeah. fix anything in my mind. And I was like, no, if I do it, I think I need to do it where I change everything.
Yeah.
And it's not just the surgery.
And that's where you are today.
Yeah.
You said something there about self-esteem. Yeah. So, and the main reason I wanted to talk to you today was because on your page, you are, as I said, you're very genuine, you're very honest, and you do open up about your past. And in your past, there was domestic violence and some relationship problems. Yeah. Is that the words we'd yeah. say? So do you want to, from the very beginning of that, do you want to start there?
Yeah. So the first time I opened up on social media about the domestic violence was I was actually doing a takeover on a page, and they just wanted to know about my whole journey. Do you know, your weight loss journey from the start and how it started. And I'd never really shared, you know, from when I started. I just kind of was like, I was in London for 9 years and then I moved home and started losing weight. But I remember this time when I was telling it, I just felt like I can't tell the story in complete honesty without kind of opening up a little bit about my past, because that really was the kind of the starting point of the weight loss journey. And it was, so I'd been in a relationship for a few years, and then I fell pregnant when I was in my third year of uni. So I was studying drama over in London, and in my third year we fell pregnant, and I decided that I would postpone uni, like I'd finish it the following year and we'd go through with the pregnancy. And it was during the pregnancy was when the domestic violence started. So
I stop you?
Yeah.
So from the beginning, you met, how long were you with him? Where did you meet him?
Okay. So I used to, before I started uni, I used to manage like a children's boutique. It was like a children's boutique and health centre in like a really posh part of London. And I had hired somebody new to start, and we became really great friends, and it was through him. So it was his friend, that's how we met. We just kind of were a group of friends, we all started hanging out. I think I was 21, maybe 22 at the time, and we started kind of just friends for a couple of years, maybe like a year or so, and then we were casually dating, and then we kind of got more serious and we were living together. And it was, I was 26 when I got pregnant with Carter. So I had started uni, he'd started uni the year after me in a different college. And then we were living at mine. Sorry. So we were living at mine and he had his own apartment, but we were kind of staying at my place. Then when I fell pregnant, I house shared with a couple of girls. So we were like, it makes more sense to obviously with the baby go into your apartment. So we moved into his apartment. And it was literally the day that we moved in. The first day that we moved in was the first time that he was physically abusive with me. And I remember just thinking, like, oh my God, like, this is my life now. I was about 4 months pregnant, I think. And he'd started drinking. So he was drinking quite heavily for maybe like a couple of months. I think it was just the stress of the situation we got ourselves into. He had kind of turned to alcohol and he'd relied on that. But it was getting to the point where it was, you know, midweek he was drinking and stuff like that. And the day that we moved in together, he was like really, really hungover. And it was an argument we had over the move. And, you know, the man with the van, he wasn't really helpful. And I can't remember how the argument started. I just remember we had unpacked everything in the sitting room and he was like frustrated because there was just stuff everywhere. And he kind of pushed me. And when I fell over, I remember knocking over like, earbuds, a pack of earbuds everywhere. And I was just in shock. And I remember just staring at them. And then he left the room and I was expecting him to come back in to be like, oh God, like, sorry. And he just came in with like a dustpan and brush and was like, clean up. And then he left the room again. And then later on, he came in and apologized. But I just always remember that moment of, like, on the ground, just being, like, in complete shock, you know, like, as in, shit, is this the start of it? You know, like, you hear about those kind of situations so much, and then you're, I used to always do this thing where every time he did something, it would get a little bit worse or a little bit, and I'd be like, this would have been my first really serious relationship where I was like, am I being over the top? Like, am I being dramatic? Is this normal? Do you know, maybe, I don't know, like, it was just a heated moment and that was it. Like, I wouldn't say, like, I wouldn't even use the term domestic violence for, like, a year or two, because I would just be like, no, my situation isn't bad enough. It's, and, like, when I look back on it, like, it was awful. It was, like, the worst kind of, because it was all forms of abuse as well. And I would be like, oh, maybe I'm just being dramatic. And you're terrified, I think, to open up or admit about it, because I remember I'd never wanted to tell a friend, because deep down I knew that their reaction would be, Jen, like, get out of there. And then the other one is, I didn't want to, like, not take away from other people, but, you know, people that have been in those situations where they've ended tragically or, you know, it's been awful. I'd be like, I don't want to say I'm in that situation because mine isn't that bad. Like, it's only really when he drinks, or it's only, you know, I would downplay it so much to myself because I was too scared to... I suppose I was just scared to admit to myself, like, it's a hard thing to come to terms with, you know, that you're in that situation and to come out and say it even to yourself, like, it's abuse. So I think for, like, a long time, I just kind of went with it. And I was also in London pretending to, like, my family at home and my friends at home that, like, my life was great. And obviously, when I first fell pregnant, it was such a shock, like, it was not planned and it wasn't where I'd seen my life go. So I think my whole life I always felt a little bit of a disappointment or a letdown because of my size, because I struggled so much with that and I was always just really overweight. I never had, like I said, a lot of confidence. Even when I was training over there for uni, I stopped applying for uni for a while and just kind of got a job in that shop, and I just felt like my life was a bit of a standstill, and I just used to always feel a little bit self-conscious of that stuff. So then to then be in this situation, I felt more embarrassed because I was like, I'm so pathetic, you know, like, I can't get anything right. And I didn't want to obviously worry people at home, and then I didn't want other people at home thinking like, God, what has she done? Like, she's gone so downhill and, you know, like, she's wrecked her life. So there was kind of a lot of, like, stuff like that I would worry about, and the kind of trapped feeling, like, I knew I wasn't going to get away from London, especially now that I was pregnant. So what was the point in telling people at home and just, you know, have them worry?
And from the first time that he did that, I know from talking to others how quickly it escalates.
Yeah, because I, like, you think, you know, one, because there was one incident before I was pregnant where I think he'd, like, threw a sock at my head, and I kind of laughed at it, but he did it out of temper, do you know what I mean? But at the time it was just like a ball of socks thing, and he kind of threw it at my head, and at the time I laughed because I was like, okay, like, whatever. But, like, looking back, it was aggression, do you know, that way. And then, like, the things that I would have noticed but didn't really notice, do you know, like, the possessiveness and the, like, constant bombarding me, do you know, checking where I am, all of that stuff. Like, and it's really cliche to say, but especially because it was my first serious relationship, like, a lot of it I was, do you know, he's mad about me,
yeah,
do you know, that kind of thing. And, like, I thought he was gorgeous, so the fact that he was even, do you know, worrying me or doing stuff like that, I'd be thinking, okay, do you know, he's obviously just worried. But then it would be things like when he was out, like, I'd hear nothing from him, do you know, or like, but I wouldn't be texting him as much. But if I did text him or ring him, do you know, he wouldn't hear anything back. But if I was to leave it, you know, half an hour without replying, like, the way that he would speak to me, the tone that he would speak to me, and I would just kind of be like, oh, he can be a bit, you know, over the top or whatever. But all those little things at the time I turned a blind eye to, looking back, like, were so obvious, like, such big kind of
red flags. Yeah.
And then, like I said, like, the day that I moved in, it, like, it just blew up so quickly, do you know what I mean? Like, they, I don't know if it's the same in every situation, but whether because my reaction was so shocked and just kept it to myself or whatever, maybe that then he was like, do you know, I can do this again. Or, you know, when he was angry, he knew the reaction or the response he would get from me when he did it, which wasn't very much, you know, that kind of a way. So I think that's probably why it escalated so quickly. But I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of it did, like, and it's not an excuse, a lot of it would have to do with alcohol, because for the first, for a long time, it was only when he'd had alcohol, you know, like when he was either drunk or had had alcohol recently. So I always put it down to that, you know, like, oh, it's just he needs to go off the drink and then he'll be grand.
He'll be grand. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Tell me, Jen, but for, like, did friends and family especially, did they meet him?
Yeah.
And what was their opinions before all of this happened?
Before all of it? I mean, family, it was grand because, you know, they're on their best behaviour when they're around them. So it's always fine. My friends as well. See, when they came over, a lot of the time I was living with the house girls. So he'd move. You know, he wouldn't be there. So when the girls came over, I'd really spend my time with them because I didn't see them very often. And it was maybe once or twice a year they'd all come over together. And then I kind of went home a lot. But we'd have nights out together. And I don't think anyone really ever, like, noticed anything or no one ever said anything. The girl that I lived with in London, she'd overheard an argument one night that we had. And she spoke to me the next day. She would have been, like, my best friend, Georgie. And she was like, do you know how he was speaking to you, like, really? And I just kept saying he was so drunk, like, he doesn't remember anything. And she's like, 'cause she actually came into the room, like, she intervened when we were having the argument, and I was, like, mortified. But it was kind of slowly after that. It wasn't long after I got pregnant, but that we were spending more time with his. And that was probably because he was mortified when she caught him, do you know, and put him in his place. So after that, we were spending kind of more time at his, but I was really close to his family. So we lived kind of on the same street as his family. So I would have been very close to them. And then, like, my family got on really well with their family. So, yeah, it was just all behind closed doors.
Do you think it was a strategic move for him, moving you away from Georgie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely do. Because even, like I said, there was nights after that when he would randomly be like, oh, will we stay at mine for the weekend, or, you know, whatever. My house was just more convenient for location for the uni and transport, so that's why we stayed there a lot more. And I would kind of be like, yeah, okay. But looking back, I feel like it was probably to kind of get me away. Now, he wasn't physically abusive at that time, but he would have been, like, quite emotionally abusive and, like, verbally abusive.
In what way, can I ask?
The verbal abuse started, that would have been a lot to do with my size, like my weight. So he would put me down a lot about that, and even to do with my uni course, because it was drama, you know, things, putting it down to that. And then it was almost like he isolated me a little bit from my friends, because he got that control and that, you know, if I ever did have anything. So when I was at uni, I worked two jobs as well, so I was kind of always on the go. I missed out on a lot of, you know, nights out with uni friends and stuff because I was working. They were all a little bit younger because I would have been a mature student, and they kind of had, you know, their moms and dads paying their rent, and they were living in, whereas I was private renting at the time. So anytime there was an occasion or a night out, something would always happen with him so that I'd have to cancel. Do you know, last minute something big had happened, or he'd plan something and, you know, make out like he had told me about it. And then I was really isolating. And then, like, after a while, like, your friends can only do so much. Mm-hmm. Like, and they were my uni friends, so they weren't, like, you know, my best friends. There's only so many times they're going to ask you when you keep cancelling. Yeah. So then it was at a point where I feel like he'd isolated me that little bit. So then with the emotional abuse, he would kind of almost throw that back in my face, you know, as in, like, you don't even really have friends here anymore, or, like, your only friend is so-and-so, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, just put me down about anything and everything. But the weight was a big one. And then the emotional abuse was just, like, a lot of the guilt, you know, like, making me feel bad, you know, that I wasn't giving him enough time, or I wasn't spending enough time with him, or I was always at work, or I was always at uni. And then because it was drama, there was a lot of rehearsals as well on top of that. So I'm always like, as well, I know it shouldn't matter, but I'm always like, I can't believe I was like 27 stone or 26 stone. And like, I was constantly on the go. I'm like, how did I not lose weight? Like, the amount of energy I used to burn, like, moving around so much. But yeah, he would make me feel really guilty, kind of almost for having a life, for having a social life. And I didn't even have a social life. Like, Do you know when you were in uni and everyone was 19, 20, they were going out like Monday to Friday, not even just the weekends, whereas I'd maybe go out twice a month with them. So like making me feel like I was always out when really I was never out.
Do you know you just had a reaction to what you just said there?
I did.
Yeah, you were like, yeah. So it still sits with you, does it?
It does a lot. Like I haven't spoken about it in a long time. Do you know the kind of way I did a good bit of writing about a month ago, like journaling kind of stuff, where I went through a lot of it. And I think for about 2 weeks, even I was texting my friend Grace this morning. And I was like, I wouldn't say that I have anxiety or suffer with anxiety. Mm. I had it really badly when I was over there. And when I came home, I lost it. But I'd have triggers. And I'm like, when I'm deep diving, and I'm just like, I hate that it still has a strong effect. But it's easy for me to push it down, but only for a certain amount of time. Mm. Like it will always resurface or something will always come up that will trigger it. And I try my best to kind of face it and to talk openly about it when I can. Because even on social media, sometimes I'm like, I wish I could do more when I opened up about it. I was really lucky that I got people reached out to me, you know, to do talks or even to do a podcast to kind of not like spread the word, but just to have an open conversation about it. Because it's not something that I think a lot of people feel comfortable talking about. And it's not something I think people expect. Do you know, because you never know who it's happened. I think people are surprised because there's still a lot of people that I don't know because I don't talk about it all the time. Mm. But it's hard sometimes with my social media page because it's so food based to then randomly throw a little bit of domestic violence in there. But it's important to me to kind of keep the conversation going. But then sometimes what people don't realise when I do open up about it is my inbox gets flooded. Mm. And sometimes I really struggle going through messages because people will reach out to me that are in the situation, you know, that are living it now and it's their life, or they'll talk to me about their past and like it'll bring a lot up for me. So sometimes I'll have to literally be like, I can't go into my message for a day or two because it just gets too much. But it's a hard one because like I do want to talk about it and I want to spread awareness, but it's just like it was only 4 years ago for me, so it is, you know, it's not that long ago either.
And you're still healing. And then I get absolutely, you know, these people are just want to share because they think, oh, maybe she's going to help me, or maybe I'm going to get something from it. But that is a huge trigger for you as well. So people need to be, and I think as well, some people would be like, you know, oh, I messaged her and she never replied back. But like, you've got to help, and a very, very raw subject that is completely overwhelming to you.
And like people have even said to me in the messages before, like, I've never told a soul this. Like I remember having a woman had messaged me and she was like in her late 50s. She was around my mom's age. And she was like, her daughter was in her 20s. And no, she wasn't with her ex-partner, but she was like, for 20 something years, like, I went through what you went through and I've never told a soul. And she was like, but listening to your story, she was like, I just really, you know, felt like I wanted to message it. And she's like, I never will tell anyone about it because that's her choice. It's her decision. But so that, like, you know, and then when you do reply to someone, you open a conversation. So like, you know, if I only replied to 10 people out of 100 people, I wouldn't just send a message back.
I know.
It's an open conversation. Mm. So then I'm having 10 ongoing conversations. But then you feel awful when you go into messages and you see one from 4 weeks ago where someone said something very vulnerable. Or a lot of times, the kind of more common message that I would get is a friend that's worried. Do you know, like my friend is in a situation and I don't know what to do. And I work quite closely, like, with Saoirse's Women's Refuge. And I kind of spoke to them about, like, I feel like I need to have a little bit of almost, like, training. Because I have to be so careful with what I say. You know, I can't be like, tell her to get out of that situation because it might be too dangerous for her to walk away. And then, you know, you don't know what the situation is like. I don't know what advice to give. All I can kind of say to them is to maybe speak to, you know, a professional place or let them know that you're there. You know, there's only so much that I can say and I have to be so careful with the advice I give. And sometimes that scares me because I'm worried if I say something wrong or, you know, if it would have a negative impact or so that, yeah, that would worry me a lot.
It's the same with the podcast. I get so many people who come on to me and to say to me, oh, I'd love to come on as a guest. I'm in the middle of this. I'm going through this. And I have to be so careful because I don't want to open a door that I cannot close.
Yeah.
And that's really important. So what you're doing, safeguarding yourself and those people.
Those people, yeah.
Is, and you just said, like, training and stuff like that as well. And that's something that maybe you'll do down the line, but you're still... 4 years is no time at all.
Yeah.
It's no time at all.
And it's been such a transformation in the 4 years. Like, you know, like, there's been so much that has gone on, like, so many amazing things as well. But that's always, you know, the main focus, and that's always there underneath everything. So, like, all the goods and the highs that I have, I still, like, I still do struggle with it, you know, but I'm a different person to who I was. Like, I've come so far. So, like, I have to be proud. I can't discredit, you know, the work that I have done on myself and how far I've come along mentally. But it's definitely, you know, like you were saying, it's ongoing, and the healing process, you know, could be the rest of my life. It could be, you know, like, I don't know how long I will be healing, but I need to be patient with myself. And like I said, I'll go through phases where I'll, you know, talk about it or I'll write about it, and... then when it's enough, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm ready to kind of shut those doors for a little while.
And when you write, do you write to yourself?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just journal. Mm-hmm. Just like, write. But sometimes I'll write it and rip it up. Do you know, I don't want to read it ever again, but I need to get it out. So I could write something down that could be 12 pages. Mm-hmm. And then other times I can't even write half a page. I'll go to write and I just can't write anything. So I'll go through phases every few months where I'll write a lot, and then I don't write at all. Because sometimes it's hard. Like, I know... journaling and writing it all out is, you know, a great way to express your emotions and to get it out. But sometimes it's really hard. And there's times where I'm like, I don't have the energy to be this upset today. Or like, I don't have the energy to feel, because this feeling can stay with me for a week. You know, it can stay with me for a month. Like I said, it was 3 weeks ago that I'd done a lot of it. And even this weekend, I was just... felt really, like, really anxious. Like, I hadn't felt like that in a long time. Now, I did have alcohol on the weekend, so that could have triggered a lot as well. But I do think I know when I've had enough, you know? Like, I know when to take a step back and be like, okay.
Very strong. You are. To be able to do that, you're very strong.
Thanks.
You know? So you should be proud of yourself for that.
I am.
Tell me this then. So he... does he come in then afterwards for the first time? Does he apologise? Did he apologise throughout or...
yeah, so the apologising stopped pretty quickly into, I suppose, the first few times. It was always the alcohol was to blame, you know, and he was sorry. But I mean, it was getting to a point where, like, he'd wake up next to me and I'd have a black eye and he'd be like, oh my God, what happened to your face? And he'd have no recollection because he would be so blacked out drunk, you know, that kind of a way. And like, that was tough because I remember I used to get upset with that because I'd be like, you know, put me through hell last night, you know, the worst night of my life, and you don't even have the audacity to remember, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you get to wake up and, you know, nothing, and I, you know, have to look at you for the rest of the day after what you kind of put me through. Mm. And I used to struggle a lot with. I hated that. That would have been kind of towards... maybe the end, you know, when he was really blacking out drunk, like he really did in 6 months go from, like, not an alcoholic to an alcoholic. And he was only the same age as me. So I'd never seen somebody spiral, like, so quickly out of control, so young. Because, you know, you think, like, when you're, like, oh, he's an alcoholic, you always just think of, like, an older man.
Absolutely.
Sitting in the bar, like, in his 60s. I didn't know any alcoholics that were that age. I'd never met one in my life. But it was just crazy to see someone... and then think of what they were like, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, like a different person. And then to just see them, like, so just at their lowest, you know. And he did struggle mentally and he had, you know, issues and he had stuff in his personal life. And again, that was another reason why I always made excuses for him, you know, stuff from his past that would come up. And I just felt sorry for him. Like, I always had empathy for him. And I think I kind of realized when I came out of the situation that a bad trait that I have, that I've always been a people pleaser. And I think that's why I stayed as long as I did. I mean, there was 100 reasons. But the fact my whole life, I was always self-conscious and had low self-esteem because of my weight. I was always on edge that someone was going to call me fat. I was always nervous going out, you know, that I'd be laughed at. So I wanted to be everyone's best friend. I wanted to be liked by everyone. I tried my best to be the funniest, most likable, so that no one would call me out on my size, that they would, instead of looking at me and just seeing, like, fat Jen. They'd be like, oh, funny Jen. So I kind of tried to make up for my size by being the nicest person I could be. And I really fell into a trap of being a people pleaser. Like, I'd never say no to anyone. And I think that was why when the relationship was in like a really toxic state, I kind of still had that thing of like, I can fix him, but I want to help him. Like, I want to support him. And then I would also be like, after all that we've been through, if I walk away and then he fixes himself and someone else gets to have him when he's back to him. And I hated that. I had such a fear of that.
You totally get that.
And I was like, I don't want to put like the last 5 years, everything we've been through, to walk away and then you meet another girl and you're sorted and you have a great life together. And then and I always had that in the back of my head, even though deep down, you know, no one can fix them. They have to fix themselves. And if you're not happy and what they've actually done to you, like, that's never going to happen. But I always had that fear. And, you know, because we had a baby together, I wanted to be the one, you know, that would help turn his life around. And, you know, like, if I did that, you know, he'd be forever grateful for me.
Did you love him in that time?
I mean, I thought I did, but looking back, I didn't. I think I loved the idea of being in a relationship, and I loved the idea of having someone that wanted me, do you know, and that loved me, well, that I thought loved me, but it definitely wasn't love. Like, looking back now, I would have at the time, I would say it. That's why I stayed, because I loved him. But it was...
Did you think, and you said it there a little bit, do you think, again, a lot of that was stemmed from your way?
Yeah, 100%. I think the whole self-esteem thing, because my self-esteem was always bad. I never had great self-esteem. I never had any kind of confidence. And then when someone breaks you to that point where, like, there was nothing there, like, I was like an empty vessel. Like, my life wasn't my life. My life rotated around him before character came. Do you know that kind of a way? Like, I'd put his needs and his wants before mine. And, like, I think in any relationship, you know, if you're doing something like that, like, that's not healthy. Do you know what I mean? And that was just the whole people pleasing thing. But it all, I think, goes back and connects to the way. Like, and I hate saying that, because, like, there's such a good positive, you know, the body positivity movement. Mm-hmm. And, like, it shouldn't matter what size you're wearing on stuff. And I 100% agree and support that. But I just wasn't that. I would have been, even now, you know, when people are saying like, oh, your page and body positivity, I'm like, I wish it was, but it's not. I still really struggle, like really struggle with body image and self-esteem and confidence. And people just assume because I've lost weight and I've had the surgery, I'm probably really confident, but I'm not at all in myself. But I think it all kind of goes back into that, like the... just having no self-esteem, and like I had no self-worth. So like if I didn't, like I just, it's hard to explain. Like it was like I didn't even like myself. Do you know that kind of a way? So he made me happy at the time, and I would do anything to kind of keep him around. Do you know that way? And his self-worth was more important to me than my own self-worth. And then obviously when character came, that started to change a little bit, because he was the priority and he was number one. And obviously that then caused, I suppose, an issue in our relationship, because he wasn't the priority anymore.
Tell me about that. Did you have Carter in the UK or did you have him
home? Yeah, so I had Carter in London, and then we didn't move home till Carter was two. So he was there the year I was pregnant, and then we lived together for a year after he was born, and then we separated when Carter was about 15 months old, and then I didn't move home till the following year, just for like...
So Carter's born, and is there any change, like does having kids change these people?
I mean, I don't think it, from my personal situation, it didn't. I mean, definitely made him more emotional, and I would definitely see the guilt more. He definitely felt a lot more guilty. I'd seen him a lot more vulnerable, you know, because he knew he was in a bad way. He knew he was a disappointment, and he didn't want to be. I think at that point when Carter was born, he was like out of work and all, like couldn't hold a job down because of the drink. And like he was falling out a lot with his family. I don't think, you know, you can have an addiction or an issue like that and then have a child and a change. I mean, maybe it has for some people. I just think it's that whole thing where it's from within.
Mm.
Do you know, like, if having a child isn't going to make you change, then, like, what is?
Mm.
And he didn't, you know, so I definitely think it's something that you need to kind of within yourself. Because I always say that with the weight loss. I'm always like, I wish I could say that I did it for me and I loved myself enough to do it and to want to lose the weight for me, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I really believe that my push was character, do you know? Like, and I think that's sad to say that I didn't love myself enough to kind of put the work and, you know, effort into myself. But
do you love yourself now?
I'm working on it. I love myself a lot more than I did love myself. So I'm definitely working on it. But I think it's a journey. And I think that's, I think unfortunately for women especially, because women's bodies and everything like that is so objectified and, you know, spoken about in media constantly. Mm. So I do think for women, unfortunately, for the majority of women, it's something that you kind of nearly struggle with majority of your life, do you know? Hopefully not always, but I think we've gotten a lot better. And I do think, you know, there's so many pages out there, even on Instagram and stuff, that are really inspiring. And it's so nice to see people on Instagram that look like you. Because I think for so long with media, like especially when we were growing up, do you know, like magazines and ads, everything, it was always a very stereotyped person. Whereas I love the way on social media you can follow who you want.
Mm-hmm.
So you could only follow people that look like you. And like, it's sad, but like, I think that would have a massive impact on, do you know, your confidence, your mental when you're scrolling and you're looking at people, you're like, she looks great, I love that outfit, and they all look like you, rather than, and I would have been like this before, where I only followed girls that looked, do you know, absolutely nothing like, they were like 6 foot size, 8 models, that I'm never going to be that. And I'd be looking at them feeling crap about myself because I didn't look like that. So, you know, there are ways, I think, now where, you know, you can take control more and you can, it's easier to kind of grow up now in the society of like inclusion and body confidence and body positivity. And it's spoken about so much more. I think the era that I grew up in, it wasn't like that. And I think because of all the issues I had with my weight and stuff, that I'm really struggling. Well, not, I'm not really struggling now, but I really struggled. And then having, you know, the relationship and the, like the emotional and the verbal abuse, like, my brain was already wired in such a bad way of how I viewed myself. And then to have someone, you know, confirm and cement all of that, like, that's been the hardest part, like rewiring how I look at myself.
Mm.
And like, I train in Back to Basics, and I do PT once a week with Mo, and he's like the best person for kind of helping me change that, like every single week. And I'm so bad for it, like I'm terrible for it, and I hate admitting it, because I think people are like, you know, they look at my page and they just assume that I'm really, you know, confident and like positive and all this kind of stuff. But every single class I do with him, I'm like, oh god, like look at the size of my arse, or like, oh, my legs are so big, or like these leggings. And you know, I'll always say something negative and he'll pull me up on a straight away, and he will nearly give me a pep talk every single Friday. That really helps. You know, like I walk away and I think about what he said. And I had a really bad week, I think last week or the week before, about my legs, because my leg surgery was supposed to be like a year or two ago, and it's kind of postponed till the end of the year. And, you know, coming into summer, I'm just like, I can't wear anything. Like, they're so obvious, they're huge, and all of the skin to me looks really obvious where it hangs. And he was like, you need to start. He was like, imagine that surgery wasn't an option. Like, it wasn't something that you could ever do. He was like, what would you do? He's like, you'd have to learn to love and accept your legs. He was like, because they're your legs and they're always going to be like that. He was like, it's how you're viewing it and how you're thinking of it. Like, you just think when you get the surgery, they'll be so much better. He was like, but, you know, your legs have gotten you where you are today. Like, they've carried you through the work you've done. He's like, you know, you should be so proud of how big and strong they are.
I know. And it just for someone to actually put it in black and white for you.
You hear them say it. And I really did. Like, I sat with that for a while. You know, like,
ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'd imagine the surgeries had never been an option. Do you know, like, it really would be either, look, you sit here and you hate yourself and you put yourself down for the rest of your life about this skin that you can't do anything about, or you just start to accept it and embrace it. And I do know a lot of girls online, like, that have had massive weight loss and they don't bother with the surgery. Now, they might not have, say, as much excess skin that I would have had. And I was like, I really admire that. Because when I opened up about the surgery, so many people were like, you know, it's a huge amount of money to be spending. Like, you're a single mom. Should you not be getting a house for you and Carter? And it was like literally the savings I used for my surgery. I was like, it's either my mortgage or it's a thingy. But at the time I was like, I'm not going to get accepted, you know, mortgage approval as a single person. So I was like, I'm going to do it for me now. And some people would say, you know, the money that you're spending on that would be better invested into a therapist, you know, about self-love. And I'm always like, I just think, you know, it's like you can still love yourself and still want to have the surgery. And every single person that would say this to me, like, I take one look at their profile and be like, you've, you know, clearly you haven't lost 12 stones. You know, you haven't struggled with weight the way I have. And like, you don't understand how painful it is. Like, it's not comfortable walking around with kilos and kilos, like stones of skin, do you know, hanging. And also because I train a lot, which is obviously, you know, fast moving. The skin was really painful. So I was like, I don't think you can say, you know, you don't love yourself if you're opting for surgery. Like, they're two completely different things. But it's just always the people that have the opinion, you know, have never been in the situation. And that would kind of irritate me because I'm like, you know, when you lose 12 stone, come back and say it to me. But for me, it was a no-brainer. I was like, I'm getting the surgery. Like, it's the best thing I've ever done. Do you know? Like,
you had to do it for you. Yeah. And you wouldn't be the mammy.
Exactly.
I always say that. Do you know what I mean? If you didn't do it. So
if I didn't do it. And it was the right time, and luckily we were at home. Do you know, my mom and dad were there, and I said, these are the years. Now, obviously, COVID kind of extended those 2 years to 4 years, but I just remember thinking it'd be a good time, and I can always get a mortgage. You know, I don't have to get it right now, and that's obviously going to be the plan after the surgery. But yeah, no, the surgery was definitely the best thing that I ever did for myself.
Can I ask you, when you were in London then, his family, did they not see it and say anything?
So they did eventually. They knew obviously the drinking was an issue, because there was one or two times he literally got dropped to the house by the police, like, because they found him out and about and he was like drunk. And I think towards the end of my pregnancy, his mom had tried to get him into a rehabilitation place, and she was really trying to get him into rehab for the drink. And he was against it. You know, he was still in denial that he had an issue. He was like, no, like, as soon as the baby comes, that's it. You know, I'll be back to myself and all. And then it was actually when Carter was only like a week, maybe 10 days old. His brother like came to visit. So his mom and dad were on holiday and his brother came over like unexpected. And we were just sitting there and I obviously had no makeup right on, but I had a really bad bruise all along my cheekbone and jaw. So like basically half my face was just black. So when he came in, I was like, oh God, do you know, I had no makeup on. So we were sitting watching the telly and I remember he was standing to like the right and the mark was on my left and he'd sat down and was like having a cup of tea. And then like a few minutes later, he just kind of looked at me and he was like, what is on your face? And I was like, what? Do you know, like acting like, what are you talking about? He was like that. He was like, there's like, I think he was a set of shiner or something, but he was like, and he walked over and he turned, he was like, what is that? And then I just burst out crying. I just was like, I didn't know what to say. And I went to the bathroom, you know, as if to be like, what are you talking about? And I was looking in the mirror. And then he actually looked at his brother and he was just like, what is that? And then he kept looking at me and was like, you tell him, you tell him. And I just was crying, didn't know what to do. And it was brother packed up everything for me and my little boy and took us to his house. And we stayed there that night. And then the next day, his sister got up with me like 6-7 in the morning. I had to queue to get into a women's shelter, you know, to get housed. So me and Carter were put on a list, like an emergency list, and I stayed with her for a couple of weeks. So the family were like amazing. They were like, I don't know where I would have been without them, you know, the support. And then I didn't see him for a few weeks, and then his mom and dad came home and he did go to rehab. So he went to rehab and then I was put into a women's shelter for a few months and eventually got my own place. And then we got back in touch. So he'd done the rehab, he was off the drink, and I was like, he's fixed, this is great. And then we didn't move in together, like we did take it quite slow. And he got a new job the following January. So this all would have been between like say May and August, the transitions and the like. I had a C-section, and like, do you know, going through all of that, my family was at home, and then having to move from my house to, you know, his mom and dad's house for a few nights, to his sister's house, to a temporary shelter, to a shelter. Like, it was just so much. And like, my family didn't know any. They just thought I was at home with him. They didn't know any of this was going on. They didn't know I was living in, you know, five different houses in the space of a month or something. I'm trying to, like, I was a big girl. I was obviously very overweight. I had my C-section scar here. And I'm, like, you know, trying to, you know what it's like when you even leave the house with a newborn, like, between bottles and bags and nappies. And I'm trying to pack every few weeks everything I owned, you know, that kind of a way. And I look back now and I do be like, I don't know how I did that. Like, I wouldn't have been able to do that now. But I think it's just one of those things when you're in it, when you're in the moment, you just do what you have to do. And I was more concerned about keeping Carter, do you know, like, I mean, he was a few weeks old, he had no clue what was going on. Once he was, you know, getting breastfed, he was fine. But I mean, I was more trying to make it out to everyone that I knew that everything was fine. That was my biggest concern, that my mom and dad didn't find out about any of this. Do you know what I mean? I didn't want them to know anything. And then I remember my mom came over, because they were kind of coming over regularly because the baby was born. When she came over the next time, I was in the women's shelter and she didn't know it was a women's shelter. It was like the studio apartment, and I just had told them that we had separated. I just said, look, we broke up, you know, he's drinking a lot and I just don't need that right now. I need to focus on me and the baby. So I said, I'm after moving. And she was like, what the hell? Like, she was so confused and so upset. And, you know, his mom and dad were really good. Like, you know, I had begged them, like begged them, don't tell them anything about the violence. And I remember even his mom was like, I really think you should tell your mom. Like, I think you'll regret it. And I was like, I will in my own time, but I just can't deal with that right now. And I can't deal with her having to go home to my dad and them know what happened. So I just said, I'll tell them about the drinking and like, we'll go from there. So I remember my mom coming over, and I just remember being sad at seeing how sad she was, because like the apartment wasn't very nice. You know, it was just like a little studio flat. It's like one room with like a bathroom and like a kind of like offset kitchen type thing. And I just didn't leave the house. Like, I sat in that room for 3 months and I would feel like the worst mom because, you know, a new baby, but it was like up 2 flights of stairs. So I'd have to carry his buggy down every time I wanted to go out. And do you know what? It was so unfair. But obviously he needed fresh air. And I remember just being so terrified leaving the house. Like, I just didn't want to leave the house in case I seen him. Now, he had no idea where I was at that time. And it was also out in an area of London that I had never lived in. I'd never been to it. I didn't know it. It wasn't a particularly nice area. And I think keeping that all a secret to everyone, even my friends from uni didn't know any of this was going on. Like, that was what was so hard, because I didn't have anyone. The only people I had that I could talk to was his family. And, you know, there was only so much I wanted to say to them. I just wish that I had opened up to someone. And like, when my mom was there, there were so many times when I really wanted to tell her everything. I remember the day that her and my dad first came to visit. Carter was like 3 days old. They stayed with us for a week. And it was the last day she was leaving. That was actually the morning that he had given me that really big bruise. But it was like 2 hours before they came over. So it hadn't come up. And I remember when she was gone, like, and she kind of took my hands or whatever. And I was like, please don't go, mom. And I was like, please. And I think I remember at the time she was just like,
take your time.
Sorry.
Grant.
She obviously just thought it was emotional because the baby. But I remember just being like, I just knew what was ahead of me. And I was like, please. I was like, just stay for a few more days. And I remember my dad and all just being like, you'll be fine. Like, you're doing great. You're doing great. And they had like no clue. Like, they hadn't a clue what was going on. But yeah, I mean, it's only when I look back and when I talk about those things that I'd be like, God, I was stronger. Like,
yeah.
Then I give myself credit for it. Do you know, kind of a way? Like, but I think when you're in those situations, like I said, you just get on one. I think especially because I just had the baby, do you know, I wanted to keep everything as smooth as possible. And I wanted to just, that was my priority. So whatever I had to do, I just did it. And you just don't think about anything else. But yeah.
So how did you get away?
So that was a long process. Getting away was because I finally opened up and told my friend. So I did end up telling my mom a year later. So Carter was about 15 months. And like I said, he got a job that January. So Carter was born in May. So the following January, he had gotten a job in like a bookies. And I remember thinking, this is going to be a great thing, or this is going to be a terrible thing, because he'd been off the drink. And his sister was like, no, I think it's really good. And he was like, he showed up every day. Like, and I was like, God, he really is making an effort. And then the last weekend of January, when he got his first wage back, he just went on a 2-day bender and, you know, came home, didn't have a penny in his bank. You know, he just, I don't know what he did, but it was a 2-day bender and that was it then. And then it was like 4 weeks of being sober again, because he'd no money. Do you know what I mean? But he was really, you know, financially abusing me at this point as well, like taking everything. Like, he'd rob my cards, he'd hide my debit cards. I had set up, like, I was savvy with it, and that, like, I had set up a second account that he'd no idea about, that I used to put money in all the time for savings, because I could say to him, like, please don't take it. I said, I've only £20 in there and I need to get nappies and baby food. And like, he wouldn't care. And that used to kill me, because I'd be like, imagine that was the case. Do you know what I mean? Because that obviously does happen. But I never let myself kind of, do you know, I always had my own little money thing there, which is probably one of the best things I ever did. But he then, this was at a point, I think the second or third month into the job, it was like the same thing, like clockwork. Like, he would get paid, go on a vendor, then be broke for the month, and then be kind of nearly groveling for the month. But I, at that point, I think I had lost any kind of, like, at that point, he just made me feel sick, do you know? Like, he turned my stomach. Like, I didn't even want to be around him. I used to dread, I'd be just getting anxiety with the thought of him coming over, even if it was just, you know, to see Carter and have dinner. I just didn't want to be in his presence at all at that point. And that was when I kind of knew I was ready to leave. So I had ended up going back to uni when Carter was a few months old, in the September. So he was 3-4 months old. I went back to do my final year, and I did my thesis. I did everything. I don't know how I did it. And I got everything handed in and I ended up graduating in the June or July. And my mum and dad came over for that and we were all going out for a meal. And I remember he was getting ready in his own apartment and I was like, we're leaving. He was like, I'm not ready, give me half an hour. And I had my mum, dad and Carolyn. I was like, no. I was like, I told you to be ready at this time. If you're not ready, like, I'm not sitting in the car with my mum and dad for half an hour, like, they've booked a dinner and all. And I used to get a bit braver, I suppose, when my mum and dad were there, because I knew we wouldn't do anything and I knew we wouldn't come to the house. So I would get a little bit braver and then be like, oh Jesus, once they left, because I knew then. But so I went to the restaurant without them, and I remember my mobile phone, I put it in my bag and I could feel it vibrating constantly, and I remember my stomach, and there's things like that that I hate, that I'm like, that graduation dinner, when I think of that, like, and how proud I was, but all I remember, even though I was with my mum, dad and character, all I can remember from that dinner is that feeling that I had, that sick feeling of, oh God, like, what is he going to say or what's he going to do? And I remember at one point checking my phone, I had like 40 something messages, just 40 messages of him saying like horrible stuff. And I was like, don't look at it, just don't look at it. And that carried on through the night or whatever. And then I remember at the time just being like, for the months leading up to my graduation, even in the last year before I walked away, I did this thing all the time where I'd be like, I'll just get to this exam. And once this exam's done, because I'm so stressed about it, then I'll deal with leaving them. Then that exam would be done. And they're like, right, I'll just get to my birthday. I'll just get through character's birthday. And there was always something that I was like, no, once that's out of the way, then I'll leave them. And my graduation was one of the things I said. I said, no, once my graduation is over, that's it. And I remember when my graduation was over, I was like, what next? Like, what's the next excuse I can use? I was like, it's kind of now or never. So he had come over to the house and it was like the middle of the day, like it was sunny outside, and he was really, really, really intoxicated. And he had never been physical to me in front of Carter. Like, he'd always put Carter in a different room. But this time he was physical with me while I was holding Carter. And that's when I was like, okay, this is dangerous. It's not even, I'd never kind of really considered, you know, the impact or like the danger I was putting him in, because he never did anything, like he would never lay a finger on him. It was only me. Even though I wouldn't be thinking, like, you know, he'd knocked me out before, I was out cold, you know, and even if it was for 5 minutes, like, that's 5 minutes characters, you know, unattended. So I think that time I was like, okay, this is it. You know, like, he's putting us both at risk. You know, if he knocks me out now and he takes character and he goes off with him, you know, and he's drunk, you know, like, that's not my fault, but I felt responsible for putting character in that situation. So I decided then, he was asking me to drive him somewhere or something like that. So I was like, in my head, just drive him there. And as soon as you drop him off, drive to your friend. So my friend from uni that I'd stayed in touch with, we were quite close. And I remember just parking up somewhere and I wrote this big long text out. And I was like, just send it. I was like, if you just send this message, once you send it, somebody knows what's going on. And she knows that you're at risk. And even if you want to deny it later, she knows about it. So I just sent it, and she was in work and she rang me straight away and she was like, just collect me and I'll come back to the house and stay with you. And she did. And it was actually that night I knew he would come back, and she was like, no, like, it's 2 o'clock, like, let's go to Betty Mountain. It was like 6 in the morning. He showed up and he was not impressed at all at the fact that she wouldn't let him in. It was like a house with 3 floors, or like an apartment block with 3 floors, and there was 2 apartments on each floor and I was on the second floor. So we were like up one story, and I remember she was at the window and she's like, you're not coming in. So he got all this like bricks and wood and just smashed all the windows in the house. He smashed my car up because that was in the garden. So she called the police, because I was like, she was like, bring the police. And I remember I was just sitting on the bed and I couldn't move. Like, I was frozen. And the police showed up and he got arrested and got released. You know, there's nothing they can do. He'd pay for my windows, which I think he'd pay me like £20 a month for a year or something. But when that all happened, Emma was like, you need to tell your mum and dad. She's like, they have to know, like, you're in a really dangerous situation now. So I did tell my mum and dad. And I remember my mum flew over the next day, like, and she was...
What did you tell her? Did you ring?
I told her, I didn't tell her about the abuse when I rang her. I just said, things haven't been good. And I've maybe been lying a little bit. And I said, he's back on the drink. And it's worse than it's been. And like, I don't feel safe anymore and I want to come home. And I think they knew then. So she literally flew over the next day and my dad booked a villa in Lanzarote, like a big, mad expensive villa with a swimming pool, like for 2 weeks later or something for the three or the four of us to go for like 10 days. And I needed that. Like, that was amazing. But it was obviously sad always having to go back to London. It was a lot harder than I thought it was going to be to leave London. So we had to go through the court system for nearly a full year. And that was really drawn out. And then...
Why?
Well, there was the domestic violence. And then there was the... I needed to be granted like leave or access to leave the jurisdiction of the UK because Carter was a UK citizen. And like, you know, the way now I wouldn't know too much with the law, but I feel like in Ireland, it's really hard for fathers to get a lot of rights. Mm. Whereas in the UK, it's not that it's different, but they're very much, you know, it's the child that matters. And they have a right to both their parents. Okay. It doesn't matter what's going on between you. It's the child's right to know both their parents. And which is obviously better. But in my situation, it wasn't. Because it meant that it just made it that much harder for us to get to leave. So from August until the following June, we were back and forth all the time at court. And then in the June, they were like, we're going to give you leave. Like, we're granting you the leave. To live in the UK or to live in Ireland again. My restraining order, I had restraining orders against him and they were still like intact for another year in Ireland. But he had agreed to do like a domestic violence course thing, I suppose. He agreed to the judge to do that because it was back and forth for so long. A lot of the times it was because he didn't do what he was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. He was late. He didn't show up to court. And instead of, I don't know, in my eyes, I'd be thinking, yeah, could they not just be like, okay, he's not ours, but it's not. It's like, okay, we'll readjourn for 6 weeks. And that was horrible that year because it was just dragged out so long and it was never ending. And then when he agreed to do the domestic violence course, when he showed up on the day of it, he denied that it happened. And they were like, we can't take people on if they're in denial. You have to be here because you're willing to change. So then the judge was just like, no. You know, you agree to do it and you've wasted time and it's an expensive thing. So she granted me the leave, but the domestic violence thing was still ongoing and I had to choose whether I wanted to continue with that or just get home. Mm-hmm. I remember speaking to my solicitor and she was like, I hate to say it because I always feel a little bit guilty that I didn't go through with it, but I know it was the right thing for me to leave when I left. Mm. But I remember her saying it to me. She said, she's like, you have, what, 10 photographs here that you've given them. There was, I think, 2 videos. She said, you would think that is more evidence than you'd need. Mm. She said, but unfortunately, these cases never really turn out how you want them. And they're so complicated. She said, we can stay. It could be another year, you know, that you're fighting and the outcome probably won't even be what you wanted to be. Mm. And I was just like, I just don't have the energy. I was like, I just don't have any more fight in me. All I wanted to do was go home. So I just decided, I remember ringing my mom and dad and he literally booked the boat like 3 days later in a van and we packed up and I just left. Never looked, but I haven't been back to London since.
Have you now? Do you think you'll ever go back?
I mean, I'd like to because it's where our character's from. You know, I'd like to show him it. And I do still have friends over there that I would speak to, you know, but I don't know. Every time I imagine going back there, I don't know. It's just a weird feeling. You know, I feel like I'd be looking over my shoulder a little bit, but I definitely think I will go back. I'll definitely go back. I just don't know when.
Are you in touch or is Carter in touch with his family?
No. So they have, they kind of, when I told them that I wanted to move, they were obviously hurt by that. Mm. You know, they wanted me to stay. And they just didn't really understand, I suppose, how scared I was. Do you know, like, I was like, I can't live here. Like, it would be no life for me in Carter. Do you know, I'm petrified to leave the house. I was like, I'm not leaving the house. And I was living out in Croydon, which is technically, it's not actually London. It's just on the outskirts of London. But I was so cut off from everyone. I was far out, you know, it was like a 40-minute drive for me to go into London to see my friends. And I didn't like going into the area where they lived because that was around where he lived. So I would just isolate myself and I would literally be relying on family and friends to come visit me, you know, which was probably like every couple of months. Mm-hmm. But no, there's been no contact. I don't imagine.
Did you look over your shoulder for a while you were here?
The first few weeks, I think I had really bad nightmares. Mm-hmm. I felt like I'm like the second I stepped off the boat, and like even when me and my dad were in the car with Carter driving from London to Wales, I still felt anxious because I was like, there was absolutely no way he even knew where we were. But I remember just still feeling like, you know, like you can't get a deep breath. Like I was constantly, and I remember as soon as I walked into the house, my mom's front door, like it was like the 12 stone fell off me. Like I just felt so relaxed. And then there was a couple of little things, like weird triggers that I would get, like because I was saying he was on, or I was on the second floor, whenever he'd show up, he would always throw like a pebble at my window. So sometimes there'd be certain noises I'd hear and I'd trigger. Or I remember one night waking up and I was like, oh my God, I woke up because I heard the noise. And I was like, shit, he's in the garden. I was like, he's in the background. And I was like having a full on panic attack and I was sweating.
Mom, terrorized.
He's not here. Do you know that kind of a way? But convinced myself, but the anxiety and all that kind of stuff, like it did leave me very quickly. Do you know, like I did still struggle days, or you know, but I think I really quickly like submerged myself into spending every minute of the day with people. And that was literally, it was like the month before I left to move home, was when I started my weight loss. That's when I started being like, okay, there's a chance that I'll be moving home and it's going to be soon. Like I felt like a failure. I was like, I don't want to be I don't want to move home and look how I look. And I'm a single mom running away from an abusive ex. I've no job. I'm 27 stone. Like I just was the lowest I'd ever been at that point. And I just felt so low on myself. And I remember that's when I was like, no, do you know, I'm getting a chance, like a really lucky second chance. Carter only has one parent now. And I really want, do you know, to prove to myself and to everyone that I can, you know, be a good mom and I'll be the best parent I can. And I want to give him the best opportunities and just simple things. I didn't want to miss out with him. And I was like, no.
But you always have, you know that?
I know.
You always have been.
Like, well, yeah.
You have.
He's always been first, but I just didn't feel it at the time. You know, I really felt like I'd failed him. And, you know, the whole situation, even though I wanted to get away from my ex, it was still his dad. And, you know, he's going to be his dad forever, that kind of thing I really struggled with. So I just remember being like, this is it. Like, I need to do it for us and give us the best opportunity now. Do you know, I felt like it was a second chance at life nearly moving home. So I was like, I'm going to make the best kind of it, take it with both hands, seize the moment. And just even my mindset became so much more positive as soon as I was back in Ireland. Do you know, like I'd wake up. Like, it's such a weird feeling, like, for when you're years in a situation where you wake up every day with that pit feeling in your stomach or your chest where you're just, like, you don't know what today holds, but that constant, like, fear almost that's in you.
What's the, like, institutionalised?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just, like, literally moving back to Ireland to wake up the next day with a smile on my face. Mm-hmm. Like, little things like that, you know, like, to just wake up and not have that worry, like, it consumes you and it takes over so much. Like I remember I was getting physically sick, like, you know, I was getting like all these weird stomach pains. The doctors couldn't figure it out. They think it was like pancreatitis, acute gastritis. The doctor was like, you know, you're under a lot of stress, like you have a newborn and you're doing your uni degree. And he was like, sometimes you can hold on to that stress and it comes out in certain ways. And I was like, yeah, and everything else that's going on as well, I internalized it. And because I didn't talk to anyone about it, like, I really believe, I mean, I know scientifically I can't prove that it was, but I really do think the way I held on to all that stuff, it came out in, like, almost, like, sickness in me then. And I think then, because, like, as soon as I moved home, never had those cramps again. Now, it could have been as well to do with the weight loss, I don't know, but I just mean...
No, but it is, like, you had to expel that in some way,
yeah.
And, like... If it didn't, it would have like caused cancers.
That's
and everything.
What people say,
you know,
like, you know, when you're building it up, like it's a physical thing that you're holding on to inside. But it was like as if when I moved home, like having my friends and I told them everything. And I mean, that was really hard as well, because seeing them get so emotional and they really struggled, kind of, you know, knowing what I had been through, and I had kept it all a secret. But it also was so nice to be able to finally, I know, because there were some times where like you're going through something and like you're going through something really, really awful. And I used to be like, I just wish someone knew what I was going through. Like, I just wish someone could just see for a second what I actually am putting up with. Do you know, like, I remember having those thoughts one time. I think he was like in the middle of hitting me or something. And I was just like, I just really wish one of my friends could see this and they just knew that I needed help, or they would reach out to me. Even if they did reach out to me, I would have been in denial and I would deny it to the ground. But it's just those moments of being like, it's just unfair that, you know, I have this life that no one knows about. And, you know, kind of like feeling sorry for myself in that way. So it was nice then when I moved home to have them. And like, I'm lucky that I have a group of friends that I've had, you know, since I was yay high, and we're very close still, all of us. It's like having a group of sisters and being able to just talk to them.
Are you an only child?
No, I have a brother. So okay. I have one older brother. Mm-hmm. And that was so therapeutic for me, you know, having that and finally being able to get it all off my chest. And I think that was even a lot of what helped me be successful with the weight loss. Like, everything just all fell into place at the right time, even though I felt like it never would. And I think I was 29 when I started kind of with the weight loss. But I feel people always say when they're trying to lose a lot of weight, like, you have your moment and you just know when it's that. And I just felt like all my stars aligned and I was like, right, everything is working. And like, my mindset was more positive. I just felt like lighter. I felt happier. I was so grateful to wake up every day and to be able to, you know, go do what I want and not feel scared or not hold myself back. And I do think that has a lot to do with how successful I was with the weight and then the training. Like, that was my therapy. Going to the gym every day was how I was released. And I think a lot of my emotions as well.
Can I ask, do you think that with your friends, did you become closer? And did it make the bond stronger? Because I always wonder how you're the person being affected by this, but also the people around you. And are they thinking, we should have known? Why did we not know? Why, like, so did that make you guys stronger?
It definitely did. I mean, I couldn't get over, like, the support I had, like, especially for the first 6 months. Like, they never didn't check in on me. They never left me alone. They took me to everything. Do you know, I was with them every day. They would make sure, you know, to give stuff up to have time with me. And I just felt like they went above and beyond for me. And I always say it to them, like, I really wouldn't have got through it as well as I did. I don't think if I didn't have my group of friends that I have. Do you know what I mean? Like, they really pulled me through and they helped me kind of at my lowest when I needed it. So, like, for me, I wouldn't say that it brought us closer, but like, it was another level, like, of friendship that I hadn't experienced before with them. Do you know what I mean? That I was so grateful for and really felt so lucky with the group of friends that I had. Do you know, like, especially getting to kind of 30 and still having the same friends since primary school and to be so close. And like, one group of friends I have now, like, there was a point where we all lived in a different continent, but we still kind of managed to maintain the friendship. But I definitely, like, yeah, I feel sorry for sometimes. Remember, some people reach out to me and it's how I felt when I was in London. Like, they're like, I don't have any friends and I don't have family that I can reach out and I can't leave them because I've nowhere to go. And that happens a lot when you're in those relationships, that they do isolate you and cut you off, and your friends maybe don't know the extent of what's going on and they just think you're not bothering. So you kind of drift. And then you're so isolated that you feel like you've no one to turn to. Even though I'm sure if you reached out to someone, you know, they would listen. But I felt like that for so long when I was in London. And I can only imagine what it'd be like if I was at home, like, to feel like that. Do you know, I always felt like in the back of my head, I had Ireland to run away to eventually. Like, if I was in London and that was it, like, do you know, I'd probably be still there. I don't know where I would be, you know, that kind of way. And that's scary. So I do feel lucky that I have a good group of friends, because I'm sure if anyone is in that kind of situation, it would be tough if you didn't.
And I think we need to kind of say to people as well that you may think you don't have friends.
Yeah.
And actually, if you just opened up and told somebody, they'll be there for you.
Yeah. I don't think, you know, many people would turn a blind eye. I think definitely there's certain people that would get uncomfortable or they might not know what to do. But I do think it's important even to make someone aware of possible. You don't have to go into detail. I did that for a long time. I just said, I don't feel safe. I'm not comfortable with certain things. I didn't say for a while, you know, that he'd physically put his hands on me. But I would just let them know that I was in a situation where I just didn't feel safe or comfortable. And there's so many places now, luckily, you know, even the stuff that I would be trying to spread awareness about. But there's so many refuges and places, you know, to reach out to. And so many of them are discreet. You know, you don't have to tell them anything. You can tell them as much or as little as you want, because it's so important to just talk, like to have even just someone to listen to you and to let them know how you're feeling. And I think, like, that's very available to people now, and that, you know, more people need to take advantage of that
and go to the right people, as you said, people who are trained
and the people that know what to do
in situations. I have to ask you about your drama, because I was a drama student. And then my dad told me that I couldn't be a drama student anymore and I had to get a real job, so I got a real
job. What happened to me?
Isn't it so bad? Like, you
when
know,
I was 18, I was like, I'm moving to London. He was like, you're not, you're going to college. So I did a year in Crumlin and did beauty therapy.
Oh my God, so did I. In Delirium,
I did it in Crumlin. I was like, right, I did my year and I still want to do drama. So I loved when I was 19. He was like, right, go on.
Did you love every second of
it? I loved it. I mean, I was doing speech and drama since I was 4 or 5. I did, you know, my grade 1 to 10, my certificate, and then I hated me and my friend Aoife, she's the one that I did drama with and moved to London with. She lives in LA now and she still does acting, but she I remember we hate the fact that it wasn't on the curriculum in Ireland, and we tried to protest it in our school to get it on. And then even the courses in Ireland for drama as a uni subject, it's just like laughed at. You know, when you tell people you're doing drama, they're like, what? But like, what are you really doing? Whereas in England, like in London, it's really, it's like a respected thing. You know, like in theatre is such a huge thing over there. So we were like, no, it's the right place to go. So we were like, we'll go there and study. But I loved it. I haven't gotten back into it since I've moved home. I worked in theatre and stuff all up until the end, you know, when I was in London. But when I moved back to Ireland, I just never got back into it.
You should.
I know, I'd love to. I do miss it. Like, it was just a good, you know, escape. Like, and it used to help me a lot when I was little, I think, with my self-esteem, because I was so shy, you know, being the little chubby girl that I always felt like on stage I was like a different person. I'm like, I'd let it all out. But now I would love to get back into it.
Clash to Doolig, they had, I went there, my secondary school, just school down at Northside Shopping Centre. And I went there for secondary school. And for me, watching, when I got to fifth and sixth year, you were allowed to go into a different canteen.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought it was really cool. But you'd see the drama students coming in, and I used to be in awe of them, you know, because they were so, they were the coolest. They were really cool. And then, so the course in Clash Doolig is actually a really good course. It's a stepping stone for a lot of people, and then they go over to the UK. But yeah, you should get back into
it. I'd love to. I mean, it's the girl that lives in LA, she was living in Ireland when I first moved home, and we had thought about setting up a drama school. This was before I started working in the bank. I was like, we'll set up like a drama school, like what we used to do. And we looked into renting a space and everything. But when we kind of put it out there, I was like, see, in Ireland, it's very much like a Wednesday evening or Saturday morning type thing. And I was like, oh, I need a 9 to 5. I was like, I need to, you know, be earning a proper income. Like, I'm a parent. So it kind of went on the backbone for a little bit. Then she moved to LA and it just never happened. Like, I'd love to, but I was like, I wouldn't have enough time to commit to it now at this moment. But it's definitely something I'd love to, even if it was just for me, do a little bit of Amdram.
But would you love to even do TV presenting or something like that?
Yeah, I don't think I'd be a very good TV presenter. I don't think I'd be good at presenting, especially not live television. But yeah, I used to be an extra in First City. Maybe they'll take me back.
I did Glenroe for a couple of seasons.
Did you?
And First City. Sure. I think, yeah, I remember meeting some of the guys and I was like, oh my God.
You're so famous.
Yeah, like Hollywood actors. And like, there's a few photos going around, and like, I think I showed Paul one of them and he was like, what the fuck? He was like, Alan, he paid. It was like one of the first gay men on Irish TV. And we were just completely in awe of him. Like, my friends, and we got a photo with him, and like a big red Larry Longhead, like horse head on me. Like, my mortified. Husband was like, "What the fuck?" I was like, "I know, but I loved it."
He was gorgeous.
He was gorgeous. And then I just want to finish up and like, you were saying about your weight loss journey now. So what's next for you? The rest of the surgery?
Yeah, the rest of the surgeries. I'm doing a good bit of training at the moment. So I started like a new program with Mo, like the PT stuff. And I'm going to try change my physique a little bit. Change things like that I'm not that happy with, kind of. Maybe like I feel like I've gotten a little bit too muscular.
Okay.
I'd like to kind of tone that down a bit and get a little bit smaller again, but still muscly.
Mm.
So he's working on a plan like that. But it's always kind of changing, you know, that kind of a way. I'm still consistent. I'm still committed with the gym. I still absolutely love the gym. It's never like a chore for me, or it's never gotten to that point where I'm like, okay, you know, I'm happy now. I don't need to do it anymore. Like, I absolutely love training where I train. So it's really just the surgeries. It's kind of after the surgeries, I'm like, and then what? Do you know, like, my surgeries will be done. Delete my Instagram page.
No, not at all. Can I ask, though, I meant to just remember really quickly before I let you go. Do you have an opinion on the Johnny Depp Amber Heard situation?
I was going to put something about this on Instagram the other day, because a few of my friends had said it to me as well. And I was like, I follow that house and habit page.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, obviously, she's very much Johnny's. So when you're watching it, it's very easy to be influenced. But I mean, from looking at the evidence and from looking at what they've shown so far, I mean, it does, to me, seem to look bad on hers. Mm. You know, I think it's hard because if she is making up or if she is lying, like, I just think that's really, because this court case has been so, you know, like, everywhere, it's all over the media, and it's been made such a big deal of, and like, if there isn't truth to it, I just think it's a little bit of an insult or a little bit of a slap in the face to the people that have been through it.
Mm-hmm.
But then at the same time, I was like to my friend, I feel like I can't completely say I don't believe her, because if that had have been me in that position, and I was saying to her, I was like, Janice, I was like, I remember I had photograph evidence, I had video evidence. I thought, like, this is grand. Like, you know, once they see that, it's, but they, like, they question you so much, and they break everything down. They really break you down going through stuff to the point where you're questioning yourself, being like, God, maybe I was a bit dramatic. Like, maybe that wasn't that big of a deal. Like, I was starting to think that way. And I think if someone was like to look at it and be like, oh, I don't believe her, she's just like, that would have killed me. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like I think it's too sensitive to me to have an opinion on.
Mm.
But from following it, I do feel like it seems to be more, you know, it just seemed like a toxic relationship.
Yeah.
And maybe he experienced as much as she experienced, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I think it's been interesting to watch and to unfold. Like, I think she will really, you know, lose a lot of respect if it comes out that she's lying.
I think it's good that it's been talked about.
Yeah.
So I do like that. One thing I do have to say, and I know, again, I'd probably be murdered for saying this, but I do find, like, some of the ads now that are coming out about domestic violence, at one point I did think they were very men-heavy, in the sense that it was just, the one where the man gets a slap off the woman. And all.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's crazy that we're actually highlighting domestic abuse right now, but we're highlighting it on women doing it to men.
Yeah. I think it's a hard one. I think it's just where they probably feel like, because it does happen, you know, like, it is definitely something that happens, that maybe it's not shown. I mean, obviously, statistically, it's proven that, you know, male violence against women is definitely the more dominant one in the situation. But it's just, I don't know, it does happen. So they probably just can't.
Yeah.
They have to share it as well.
And just for anyone, Saoirse's
Women Refuge.
Yes, okay, so that'd be one that you do look quite, you know, a bit.
And then Women's Aid obviously would be a big one as well in Ireland. You know, if you're looking for any kind of, there's so many different avenues, I suppose, when it comes to domestic violence and your needs. You know, they'd be a great one to go to. There's apps and stuff as well that you can get. And there's also good information if you're a friend or a family member that's worried.
Okay.
Because that, like I said, is a big one. If you're concerned of anyone in a certain situation, there's really, like, a lot of safeguarding. Like, there's, you know, proper steps to take, and they give you the correct information, and they'll ask you certain questions about, you know, what you've seen, what you've witnessed, and maybe the next best steps going forward. I think that's a really handy one to have, because I would get a lot of questions about that.
Jen, on that note, I'll leave you because I know you had to collect Carter as well. Two of us are talk to you for hours. Thank you so much for doing this. I think it was a really important conversation. And as I said, if anyone, you know, is struggling or needs any help at all, Women's Aid, or reach out to your local Women's Refuge, like Saoirse, and so on. I'll tag everything here in any way as well. But thank you.
Thanks a million. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.